You are listening to the cycling podcast, A De Vuelta a España, in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run. Stage 3. Today we are in Alicante.
Nicola, that was some group you were in yesterday, but what was going through your mind on the run-in knowing that the stage win and the red jersey were both up for grabs?
Yeah, well, obviously at that moment I was thinking of the stage win. It did come to my mind at some point. I did ask on the radio, am I actually in for the red jersey? And the clear answer was, Nico, if you win the stage, you're in the red jersey. So I said, okay, fair enough. So I focused on trying to win the stage. That didn't happen. But I was extremely satisfied once they gave the result that I was in the red jersey.
Did you know the onus was probably going to be on you to chase down Quintana? And were you trying not to get suckered into doing all of the work there?
Well, you know, when in such a small group, obviously it's kind of the responsibility of every one of the riders to chase it up the road. I clearly saw that Uran was not really into closing the gap straight away. He was more interested in going. So when I went, he closed the gap straight away onto me, but then he kind of stalled and Roglic went, and that kind of helped me to get me back into position for the sprint. But, you know, in those type of finishes, it's always a game of cat and mouse, and it's very tactical too.
And lastly, what are you thinking in terms of defending the jersey a couple of days and then see how it goes?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully today and tomorrow would be already quite a great thing. And then Wednesday, I think it will depend more on legs than anything else.
That was Ireland's Nicholas Roach, the leader of the Vuelta a España, speaking this morning in Ibi before the start of Stage 3 to Alicante about his prospects of keeping the red jersey in the Vuelta, and also what was going through his mind when the stage and the red jersey were both up for grabs yesterday. And what a day it's turned out to be for the Irish, because in Alicante this afternoon, Sam Bennett won his first Vuelta stage. Daniel, where are we? We're at your hideaway, your hacienda in the hills. We can hear the wild dogs barking in the distance.
If in doubt, you'll always find me in the hills, won't you? Napalm, well, away from the hustle and bustle, in immersed in nature.
Well, you've done well to find such a secluded little spot on one of the busiest coastlines in Europe.
But I feel that we need to redeem some of what we've said about the Costa Blanca. We've not been terribly, terribly complimentary, probably not just this year, but over the years about the Costa Blanca. But we're in Altea, and it's definitely one of the prettier places in the Costa Blanca, isn't it? The old town, which is set a little bit back from the coast, lovely whitewashed Spanish village / town, cobbled streets, and very colourful. Yeah, quite pretty.
It is very pretty. We went for a late drink after dinner last night, and well, as Spain often is, it was alive until the early hours. I think we retired at 12:30 last night, maybe a little bit later. Daniel, that was Jonathan Rowe and myself just debriefing after a busy day on the Vuelta. But yeah, before you know it, it's 7:00 in the morning again, and it's been pretty warm over the weekend, but a little bit cooler inland today at least. Let's recap what happened on stage 3, because as I say, Sam Bennett won the stage. The Irish champion added it to the 3 Giro stages he won last year, and he extends Bora Hansgrohe's really impressive run of Grand Tour sprint stage victories this year after Pascal Ackermann at the Giro and Peter Sagan at the Tour de France. The early break today featured King of the Mountains leader Angel Madarazzo. You know, Madrazzo was King of the Mountains at the Tour of Britain in 2013 when Sam Bennett won a stage in Caerphilly. I remember seeing them both on the podium at various times there a few years ago now. And Madrazzo was in the break with Diego Rubio of Burgos BH and Hector Saiz of the Euskadi Murias team, as expected, really the Spanish wildcard teams putting men up the road. They were all caught with around 40 kilometres to go. And on that final climb before a fast, furious, tailwind-assisted descent into Alicante, Fernando Gaviria of UAE Team Emirates was dropped, and he had a fruitless chase with Sergio Henao and Marco Mercato for company, but they got within sight of the peloton, the back of the peloton. They could see the line of team cars, which were pulled over, actually, to assume so this chase couldn't be assisted artificially. Anyway, Gaviria didn't get back on terms, so that was one less sprinter for Sam Bennett to worry about. And in the sprint, Bora Hansgrohe did everything right, and Bennett got over the line ahead of Edward Thurns of Trek Segafredo. No change overall. Bennett, though, his impressive run continues. He's won a stage of every World Tour stage race he's done this year, except the Tour of Romandy. And, well, we've talked about it all year, the decision not to select him for either the Giro d'Italia or the Tour de France. He really has done absolutely everything to prove that he is worthy of a crack at the Tour de France next year, whichever team he ends up being with.
And it's curious, isn't it, Napalm, that we don't know where he's going to ride next year. We think it's going to be De Koenig Quickstep. That would seem to make sense. But Sam Bennett's given a couple of interviews this week in which he sort of expressed his own surprise that it hasn't been done yet. I just wonder whether they're wrangling or whether there's still things to sort out about who he brings with him. I would imagine that he may well want to bring Shane Archbold, his Kiwi lead-out man, with him. Archbold was sort of rescued from oblivion, wasn't he, by Bora Hansgrohe this year, at the start of this year. And it's proved to be an absolutely inspired move. I don't think today was a great example necessarily of the work that Archbold does. In fact, I sort of saw them embrace at the finish line, Bennett and Archbold. And Bennett thanked him, and Shane Archbold replied, "Well, I didn't do anything. You didn't need me at all today." But generally speaking, this year I think he's been pretty key to the success that Sam Bennett's had.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyons Run.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. Pedaleur de Charme nominations can come in at any time if you see anyone doing some charming pedaling during the Vuelta, and the winner, as voted for by you, the listeners, will receive a Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt, which will be presented to them over the weekend. We'll probably open the poll on Thursday evening, so get your nominations in on Twitter at @cycling_podcast or on Facebook. And if you want to buy a Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt, you can do so at rafa.cc. And if you search Pedaleur de Charme, the whole range of clothing will come up. The first victory, Daniel, for an Irish champion in the Vuelta a España. The Irish championship has been won by various riders. Nicholas Roach, a former winner. Dan Martin, Conor Dunn lost a couple of years ago, sorry. And this year, Sam Bennett, of course, and wearing the white jersey with the green band and the shamrock on it, got over the line first today. Very impressive. And really, he's been one of the sprint stars of the season. And it's this run of winning on every occasion that he's had the opportunity to do so, apart from the Tour of Romandy, where basically he probably would have won the stage had they managed to bring in Stefan Kung on the only day when it ended in a sprint. He's an impressive sprinter, isn't he? He's an impressive guy.
Yeah, he is. I think what's been remarkable, and he sort of said this as well today, has been, or where he's really improved in the last year or two, has been the sort of expenditure of energy before the sprint. And he comes in, generally speaking, looking very sort of cool and not having to sort of surf the wheels too much and not flapping, not panicking. I think the margins at the moment between the sprinters in terms of raw speed are pretty small. I don't think there's a clear kind of leader or someone who's clearly faster than all of the other guys. You know, even if we look at the Tour de France, and Caleb Ewan won three stages, but I don't think he was superior in the way that Cipollini was in the 90s, or Pataki after that, or Cavendish after that. I think the margins are still quite fine, but I think another area in which Bennett has really progressed is just confidence. I don't think he necessarily fully believed himself 18 months ago, 2 years ago, or he certainly didn't believe that he was the strongest sprinter around. And I think he's starting to feel that, and rightly so.
Yeah, I think that confidence is married with a kind of an intense self-criticism almost, and public self-criticism. Remember when he didn't win in Israel at the start of the Giro last year, he was really quite harsh on himself and drew attention to the mistakes that he felt he'd made in those stages, which not many sprinters tend to do. They, you know, tend to sort of try and keep their mistakes hidden under wraps, perhaps for fear of giving the opposition a bit of an advantage or just for not to attract further criticism. But you mentioned there the stream of riders in the past who have had the undisputed fastest man in the world tag. And there isn't really a sprinter that could lay claim to that. There's quite a broad base of very good sprinters, but no kind of one outstanding rider. One outstanding sprinter who really could have said for a couple of years that he was the fastest man on the planet was Marcel Kittel, the subject of our first kilometer zero of this Vuelta a España. Not racing here, of course, because he has announced his retirement, but he did kick off his Grand Tour sprinting career with a victory in the 2011 Vuelta. So we spoke to a few of his former teammates and also his former team boss, Patrick Lefebvre, about Kittel, and that episode is on the feed now. Kilometre Zero, Auf Wiedersehen, Marcel, it's called. Now, before we move on, let's just hear a quick word from the runner-up today, Edward Turns of Trek Segafredo, and he's in no doubt that Sam Bennett is in a very rich vein of form.
I think in the end I have to be happy. I think it's clear already in the Bing Bong Tour that Bennett is the fastest sprinter at the moment, and we did again a great job with the team. John brought me really, really well into the last kilometer, and yeah, I started my sprint and Bennett is just faster than everybody, I think. So I'm a bit disappointed that I couldn't finish off the great lead out John did, but in the end I think I have to be also realistic and see that Bennett is the fastest, so we maybe have to hope he is one day in a worse position than normally. The speed was just very high. I expected it would be a very hectic finish, and with Alex Kirsch we have a great guy to bring us to the last kilometer, but I lost him a bit with 1.5 to go, but suddenly I found John on the right side inside the last kilometer, and he went full, and yeah, it was a great lead out. I did what I could, but Bennett was faster.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Seb Piquet and indeed I interrupt this latest installment of our Vuelta coverage to tell you that tonight's episode is sponsored by Harry's. It has to be me endorsing this product because the people at Harry's took one look at Lionel and Daniel's hirsute, some might say scruffy and unkempt faces, and decided they were not qualified to endorse their razors. They didn't really, I should add, in the interests of accuracy. Harry's have a special offer for Cycling Podcast listeners, offering a trial set for £3.95. All you have to do is go to harrys.com/cycling. And I can tell you that not only are the razor blades great quality, but they're also very reasonably priced, much cheaper than their competitors. What do you get with the trial set? Well, you get everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. Weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineer blades with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and travel blade cover. Get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95. Support the Cycling Podcast and get your trial set delivered to you, including the razor handle, the 5 blade cartridge, the foaming shave gel, and the travel blade cover, by going to harrys.com/cycling right now. That's harrys.com/cycling.
Thank you to Richard there, interjecting to point out that we are scruffy and unshaven. Well, maybe I'm scruffy. You're certainly unshaven, Daniel.
He's such a dad. He's so conventional, isn't he?
He'll listen to this. You do know that. A couple of riders in the peloton have been keeping audio diaries for us, and they're off to a cracking start. It's been really interesting listening to James Knox of De Koenig Quickstep and Nick Schultz of Mitchelton Scott every day. And, well, let's hear what their thoughts on stage 3 were today. First of all, Nick Schultz and then James Knox.
So, stage 3 of the Vuelta done and dusted. In theory, a pretty easy day on paper. It certainly started off that way. A three-man break took off right from the gun, and the peloton was really controlled for most of the day, and it was looking like it was going to be that way for all of it until we got to a climb at about 40k to go, where Jumbo Visma decided they were going to light it up and cause a bit of havoc. Although nothing eventuated from it, it certainly made what could have been a little bit of an easier run in a bit harder and certainly a bit more stressful. But I think that's the welter, and that's what the sprint days are like here. You never know what could happen, particularly with the depth of climbers in the field. So you've just always got to be ready and looking after the leaders in the team. But it's always nice to be racing in Spain. I live here in the northern part in Girona. I speak some Spanish. It certainly almost feels like a home race, as close as you can get to it, really. I spend 11 months of the year over here, so I think it's certainly nice to be racing in Spain. It's also good to be catching up with old friends and teammates from Cajaral. They're always a friendly bunch, and it was like a family there. So it's always nice to touch base with those guys, and they're having an excellent Vuelta so far and an excellent year. So that's really great to see. Tomorrow, in theory, another sprint day. Although of course there is a 5k climb thrown in there again at around 40k to go. So who knows, Jumbo-Visma might light it up again, and it could be a GC day. I do believe there could be a bit of rain on the forecast too, so that could be pretty sketchy, as down south these roads are pretty slippery, even in the dry. So it'll be interesting to see what happens tomorrow. Cheers.
Well, that's stage three done. Another one ticked off. Not the result we were hoping for with the team getting behind Fabio for the sprint. But we'll keep trying, and of course we'll get behind him. I think it was pretty difficult, to be honest. You know, I wasn't there myself, but the last 30-40k were all out, full gas, and also with a tailwind it was really, really fast, and it kind of meant that timing was crucial. And I don't think the boys were in a bad position, but they didn't get it quite right. So yeah, I know Fabio's disappointed, so hopefully he can get a stage win further along in the race. But as for myself today, it was one of those days, never really got going. It's kind of a weird feeling, these stages, when you're in the bunch, sort of trying to coast, take it easy. It's kind of strange because it's a bit stop and start, and the bunch ends up sort of playing with the breakaway. So the brake try and slow down, and then the bunch starts to slow down, and then the brake speeds up, and then the bunch speeds up, and this sort of goes backwards and forwards all day, basically. So yeah, and we were sort of going in and out of towns and roundabouts, and I was kind of, to be honest, I was wanting to be a bit lazy and sitting down the back. So quite a few times I got a bit of a shock when we had to sprint out of corners, sprint out of roundabouts, sprint out of towns when it was all strung out. And yeah, it's never nice when you've sort of been soft tapping for a few good 10-20 minutes, and then suddenly you got to go all out for 2 minutes. But all in all, not a bad day.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. As ever, there's a 25% discount code. You can get 25% off all of their products. Go to scienceinsport.com, and when you get to the checkout, enter the code SISCP25. Now, Science in Sport have introduced a vegan range. It's called the Plant 20 range, and it provides an all-natural vegan approach to on-the-go protein whilst also being low sugar. Packed with protein, a key nutrient in the growth and maintenance of lean muscle mass, Science in Sport's great tasting range is ideal as a snack or as a way of topping up your protein intake throughout the day. The Plant 20 range of bars and powders is available, of course, on scienceinsport.com. And well, that kind of appeals to me, that, really. If you're going to use energy products for your cycling or your running or whatever, to know that there's an option that's not using animal proteins, I think that will be pretty popular. Now, Daniel, you tweeted something a little bit earlier on this evening about the Italian super agent and the Movistar team, a story that's appeared in the Spanish press today that caught your attention, and if it interests you, it'll probably interest our listeners. What's been going on?
Well, bit of the sort of context to this, Giuseppe Acquaro is an Italian agent who, well, I think a lot of fans, a lot of followers of cycling, they might be familiar now with the name, and we've probably mentioned him in the past. He was infamously at the start of his career, and if he was listening to this, he wouldn't thank me for reminding people. He was infamously known in the Italian peloton as il pasticcere or il pasticcino. Pasticcino is kind of a cupcake. Il pasticcere is someone who makes pastry, basically, a kind of baker. And why was he called that? Because He started his career, well, before he was an agent, he was some kind of pastry croissant wholesaler or distributor. He worked for a distributor of baked goods. And
why am I thinking of the Pillsbury Doughboy suddenly?
Well, and we're talking around sort of 2003, 2004. Gianni Savio, the great friend, our great friend of the podcast, Gianni Savio, he is well known for having brought a lot of Colombian South American riders over to Europe. And traditionally, they have been put up in a hotel outside Turin in a place called Cossato. And Giuseppe Acquaro used to deliver his pastries, his baked goods, to this particular hotel. And in the course of his deliveries, he became quite familiar with some of the South American riders who were riding for Savio's team, including Jose Rujano, the Venezuelan rider who finished second in the Giro in 2005. And over the course of these conversations, Acquaro offered to act as an agent for Rujano. And to cut a very long story short, he acquired the custom of Rujano, and then a lot of South American riders thereafter, gradually grew his portfolio, upset some people along the way, including Gianni Savio. There was a period in which Gianni Savio would not use Acquaro's name. He would only ever refer to him as il pasticcere. And in the last few years, Acquaro has become very, very close to Dave Brailsford, and he has supplied a lot of riders to these what was formerly Sky, now Ineos. And he's continued to fall out with team managers. He fell out with Patrick Lefebvre over Michal Kwiatkowski. He has now, not for the first time, we're led to believe, falling out with Eusebio Unzué, the team manager of Movistar. There had been tension in the past over Nairo Quintana, who's an Acquaro client. But apparently the main seed of discord this time has been the Carapaz move away from Movistar to Ineos. And over the past few weeks, it's sort of escalated. Unzué doesn't want to work with Acquaro anymore. Carapaz, according to the piece in El País today, written by Carlos Arribas, Carapaz did not crash in training before the Vuelta, as we were initially led to believe. He was actually doing a criterium in Holland. And Movistar and Unzué were unaware of this. Acquaro didn't inform them. He said, well, why should I inform them when Eusebio is refusing to deal with me now? And Acquaro's got several riders currently under contract with Movistar, so winner Anacona, Carlos Betancourt, Nairo Quintana, and of course Carapaz. But there seems to have been a sort of mutual resolution now between Unzué and Acquaro not to work with each other. And, you know, for a team like Movistar, which has huge, well, the sponsor has huge commercial interest in South America, Acquaro has, well, the bulk of his client portfolio is from South America, certainly the ones that bring him the most sort of money. The Orans, the Quintanas, the Carapazes, the Ivan Sosa. It's a problem. It's a problem for Movistar, and you know they're kind of rebuilding next year with Enric Mas. They're taking from the Koenig Quickstep, and they're taking Dario Cataldo from Astana. But really, you know, if you, in terms of sort of star quality and prestigious names. It's looking slightly sort of threadbare, their roster for next year compared to the roster they've currently got. But this is, you know, it's an interesting issue. It's an interesting sort of subject of conversation about Quadro and you know, this kind of emerging species of the super agent in cycling, which we've seen, you know, we've seen it in football, we've seen the likes of Jorge Mendes and Mino Raiola, and these have become kind of infamous names in football because of the power they wield over teams. And there was another story in L'Equipe today about Kenny Elesson's exclusion or his non-selection for the Ineos Vuelta team. He was sort of taken out at the last minute. Carlos de la Cruz was put in, and in L'Equipe they sort of speculated that this was also to do with Quadro, because Quadro has this great relationship with Dave Brailsford. He'd sort of said to Brailsford, look, I want to put David de la Cruz in the shop window in the Vuelta. Why would Brailsford agree to do that? Well, he's got half a dozen, if not more, I think he's got more than that, Quadro clients on his book. So, you know, it's kind of in his interest to keep Quadro sweet as well.
Yeah, this is a sort of great opaque area of all sport, really, isn't it? In football, some clubs have such close relationship with agents that they get many of their players, you know, offered to them on a plate by the agents. And I think if even a team of Movistar's strength and power, the risk of kind of trying to eliminate an agent who has, you know, without wanting to sort of cast aspersions on the role of agents in sport, but they do probably wield a little bit too much power. They have they certainly have their own interests and the interests of their clients at heart. You couldn't say that they don't, but they're, you know, with Carapaz riding an exhibition race basically a week before the Vuelta, I mean, that's not the sort of thing that you would expect an agent who's looking for sort of the medium to long-term prospects of the rider. It's not the sort of thing you would expect them to endorse, really, or you wouldn't expect a good agent to endorse. I mean, yeah, going off and riding for some money, it is done after the Tour de France, and maybe taking the view that it's a short career, relatively speaking, make hay while the sun shines. But yeah, you know, in a sport like cycling, where a crash can then rule you out of a race, well, it's a good job that the ink is dry on that Ineos contract, of course, and perhaps that was the thinking behind Carapaz riding that event. But yeah, an interesting one, and the role of agents and whether it's good or bad for teams and riders is quite an interesting one. It's funnily enough, somebody suggested that as a subject for one of our Friends of the Podcast specials, so maybe we'll look at that next year. Now, you mentioned Ineos. This morning, Richard set me the task of trying to find out exactly what had gone wrong for them yesterday. Theo Gegenhardt and Wout Poels were in a group nearly 10 minutes down. I didn't manage to speak to Theo this morning. Daniel, you saw him, did you?
I did. Had a chat with him, asked him what had gone wrong yesterday, and he was in a very good position. He felt fantastic, he said, all day until the peloton reached the Cumbre del Sol climb, and I think it was Hugh Carthy who really upped the pace going into that climb and did a great job for EF, because I think they wanted a small group when they got to the top, a group of about 20 or 30 riders, and that's what materialised. But when Carthy accelerated, Theo immediately felt that he was struggling, and he pretty much parked up. He couldn't even get onto the back of the group, which finished about 2 minutes down with David de la Cruz in it. He ended up coming in 10 minutes down. And he thinks that the heat may have played a role yesterday. He struggled last year with the heat as well at the Vuelta, so it's obviously an issue that I think he'll be thinking hard about, the way he can kind of address that, if indeed that was the problem. I think he was speculating as well. He wasn't entirely sure, but that's certainly one hypothesis.
I did speak to Oliver Cookson, who's part of the staff at Team Ineos, and he said that, you know, those young guys, sort of bracketing a few people together from the team, you know, Sivakov, Theo Gegenhardt and a few others, are very, very hard on themselves, or have very high expectations of themselves. And so, you know, the disappointment, particularly for for Gagan Hart after crashing out of the Giro after, you know, a very good opening couple of days, and then you know, it kind of all unraveled for him a bit over a few days, and then of course he had the crash, and he's more or less been on the sidelines waiting for this race. And yeah, the chances, they come and go, don't they? And it's going to be interesting to see what he can do in the rest of the race, because it's such a long way still to Madrid.
Yeah, and we talked a couple of weeks ago about this sort of emulation effect among this generation of young riders, and they see their peers doing very well. They see their young teammates doing very well. In Gagan Hart's case, he's seen Sivakov, you know, finishing the top 10 in a Grand Tour. He's seen Egan Bernal win the Tour de France. And you know, that can galvanise them, and it can make them think that anything's possible. But the flip side is that it puts a certain amount of pressure on them as well, because they feel that these are the guys I was competing against as an amateur. I was as good as them, or nearly as good as them. They're getting these fantastic results. I should be getting those results as well.
Just before we go, I went across to the zone technique. What would that be in Spanish? The zone technique.
Zona técnica.
Well, that's where all the TV people prepare for their broadcasts. Had a chat with Ola Shenoui before they went on air for Eurosport, and also a conversation with Bradley Wiggins, which will feature in an episode of Kilometer Zero in a few days' time. But while I was talking to Wiggins, I asked him about the decision to bring the shutters down on the Wiggins-Lacolle team at the end of this season. Quite a few riders have come through the ranks there to make it to the World Tour. Owain Doull and James Knox riding this Vuelta, they both rode for Wiggins-Lacolle. And at the moment, well, they have the coming sensation, I guess, Tom Pidcock. I mean, we don't want to overhype him too soon. He was doing very well at the Tour de l'Avenir before crashing out. His plans for next year still a little under wraps. But let's hear from Bradley Wiggins about the decision to bring the team to a halt, and also from our audio diarist, James Knox, about his time with Wiggins-Lacolle.
Well, I think it's just come to a natural end, really. You know, just trying to fund it each year was becoming difficult. To take it up again, and more infrastructure, more professional infrastructure, you know, in terms of a team doctor and things like that, physios and that, to give more support to the guys, would have needed more money. And my involvement's kind of lessened the last year or two with other things that I'm doing, particularly now with the Grand Tours and that, and next year with the Olympics as well. I'm going straight out to Tokyo after the tour. It's just becoming more and more difficult, really. But what it did do, I just look back with fondness, really, because, and the last success story for me was really Gabs Kulluk, who was obviously not under 23 anymore, was ready to retire from the sport at the end of last year, and we gave him basically a bike and a jersey to race this year and said, go and do the races that aren't under 23 and see what you can do. And he ended up getting a contract with Movistar for 2 years. So it is a shame, but I think a lot of teams are struggling. I believe Madison Genesis is going. George Hincapie told me that his team are, you know, they're struggling each year, the Holowesco lads, and you know, I think it's part of the sport, really, and particularly in the UK as well, which is where most of our funding comes out of, is Brexit's not helping anything, the uncertainty, the financial sector. So yeah, I think that's kind of where we're at, really. Rather than reflect on it with sadness, just I reflect on it with what we did for a lot of these guys that are here racing today.
And lastly, what about Tom Pidcock? I mean, he's had a crash in the Tour de l'Avenir, but yeah, clearly in great form. And well, I mean, this, you know, you can put his name almost in amongst all the other talented sort of under 23s who are coming through. It seems like there's a lot of them, and he does look like the genuine article. Do you know what will happen?
We're not too sure where he's going to be in terms of a professional contract. But for me, he's like another Remco Evenepoel. You know, he's just. He had a bit of a plateau period after that junior ranks, and now this season, you know, we've obviously winning the world title, Paris-Roubaix under 23s, and that he's just going from strength to strength.
Definitely quite sad as well to see the announcement of Wiggins-Lacolle, as it's called now, ending the other season. Had a bit of a chat with Owain Doull about it today in the bunch. Two of what I think is now going to be nine at the end of the season, nine riders who've moved up from the team to professional ranks, which is only in the last 4 years, I think. So the team's done an amazing job in the brief time it's been about to move guys forward, and I think it's going to be sorely missed for that. I'm not entirely sure yet if there's anything is going to fill the void. I have only really, really good memories from the team. I was actually quite apprehensive when I joined, sort of worried that I was being promised the world and I was going to get let down. But I got an amazing program. I got the opportunities to develop, doing some quality racing, and it set me up perfectly for the transition to the pro ranks. So yeah, it's a shame to see it go, and hopefully the guys in Britain can get an opportunity to keep progressing, because that pathway is needed, to be honest. I still personally doubt, especially for climbers and stage races and stuff, that the scene in the UK is perfect. I'm not sure if I'd stayed in the UK if I would have made the step up, because the racing there is more about the power and one days and stuff like this, and it's kind of hard to get noticed as well. You know, I'm not sure how many of the big World Tour teams are sort of looking at what's going on in the UK, even though the quality of the racing is high. So yeah, it's not a great situation just at the moment with Madison folding and JLT last year as well.
Well, it is time to go now, Daniel. We are hoping to have paella tonight.
We are. We're not quite in the province of Valencia yet. Oh, we're still in Alicante, I think, tonight. Paella, of course, is Valencia is famous for paella. But we're gonna jump the gun a bit, aren't we? Because we're also staying in Valencia tomorrow night, so we'll probably have paella tomorrow night. I'm gonna cheat slightly, Napalm, because I won't be having the genuine sort of paella valenciana. I'm not a massive fan of seafood, so I noticed. Well, we're going to eat in the same place we ate last night, and I noticed there was a kind of vegetarian option.
The thing about paella is that it's always for two people, isn't it? They don't want to make one portion because it's quite involved. Obviously, a lot of rice. It takes quite a while to prepare a good one, I think. But I mean, vegetarian paella, I'm going for the full traditional with the seafood and the meat.
Well, I need a paella partner, so who's it going
to
be?
Well, I guess it will have to be your ITV cameraman, Scott, or unless you can persuade...
He's a massive seafood buff.
Well, it looks like you may have to just pick the seafood out of your paella. Very quickly before we go, just a mention for the tickets that are on sale for our upcoming tour of theatres around England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and Ireland. They are on sale now at thecyclingpodcast.com. Go to live events and, we're off to a roaring start in Belfast and Dublin, and also doing pretty well in Bristol. There's a couple of dates in London, but the people of Cardiff, the people of Worcester, you know,
I've got a theory about why the ticket sales in Worcester aren't going too well. It's because I was a huge Warwickshire County Cricket Club fan when I was growing up, and they're our arch rivals.
Oh, I see. That's why. Yeah. I'm trying to remember if Worcester is on your half of the tour. I don't think it is. No, I don't think it is, Daniel. You won't be joining us in Worcester. We'll reveal our lineup a little bit closer to the event. Right, before we go, a very big thank you to some people who have signed up as friends of the podcast. The latest episode was my lunch with Jonathan Vorters in Castres on one of the rest days at the Tour de France. Quite an intimate chat we had, really, and people have seemed to enjoy listening to Jonathan talk about his life and career. You can sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com/friends. And by doing so, not only do you get to listen to the episodes that we produce throughout the year, but you help support us covering the Grand Tours and producing episodes for free all throughout the year. So a very big thank you to Claire Grady, Christopher Rogers, Rhiannon Wolfe, Tim Banner, Neil Sullivan, James Lacey, and a special thank you to Will Beresford, who bought a Friends of the Podcast subscription as a gift for his wife, Lucinda, and today is their second wedding anniversary.
And thanks too to Gregor Graham, Peter Lockie, Alfredo Gisholt, Andrew Owens, James Kurse, Keith O'Sullivan, Stephen Sherrill, and Jerka Christiansson.
The pronunciation police would have a field day with us reading out the names of the friends of the podcast.
I can't pronounce the English names, can I?
It's quite gratifying to see you struggle with pronouncing something. It's almost payback. We should probably select these to give you the trickiest ones. Anyway, that's all from the Vuelta a España for this evening. We will be back tomorrow for a report on how good our paella was.
No. Our vegetarian paella.
Incorrect.